Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith and hope with Stephen O'Doherty.
The Fountain of Public Prosperity, Evangelical Christians in Australia, 1740 to 1914 by Stuart Piggott and Bob Linder is a very, very significant book. It's pretty weighty. It's dense with information about the formation of Australia from a convict settlement to a liberal democracy. It's volume one of a two-volume work. And it's the lifetime work, pretty much, of Stuart Piggott. Stuart Piggott's a guy I've known for a long, long time. He has very impressive credentials in the areas of both history and theology. He's a fellow of the Royal Historical Society and of the Religious History Association of Australia. He was the foundation president of the Evangelical History Association of Australia. He's a lecturer in ancient history at Macquarie University at the moment. This book explores something that I have wanted to see in print for a very long time, and partly because I've known that Stuart has been writing it. You see, Australia was founded as a humanitarian act by a group of Christians known as the Evangelicals, and they get a lot of press these days, but the Evangelical movement goes back to the 1700s in Great Britain, and it ends up with great acts of work. It ends up with the abolition of slavery, for example, and many other social reforms of the day whose underpinnings and whose values continue to be themes in the Australian history and indeed into our future if we'll allow them to. If you're a person who wants to know what it was that the original idea was behind the founding of Australia so that you can apply it to the way that you work in the world, this is your book. And the author is Dr. Stuart Piggott.
Thank you, Stephen. A delight to be here.
What do you mean when you say evangelical? Let's get hold of this word. It's so often misused and misunderstood and often used as a term of derision by the secularists. But what do you mean when you say evangelical, especially in the context of the 18th century, when the evangelicals of the day started talking about a colony in the South?
This is the story of the evangelical movement, which I believe, as a movement, began in the evangelical revival of 1740, the Great Awakening. Other people, of course, want to take evangelicalism back to the New Testament and to the Reformation, and that's perfectly legitimate. But as a movement, as a discrete movement, I think that it originated with revival. So revival has always been a key ingredient of it. What the revival was a revival of a vital personal faith in Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ was the great hero of the evangelical revival. And Jesus Christ has been the most important person, I think, in Australian history in terms of giving us the values which really matter to us. And Jesus has been found in every community because the church has been such a widespread presence in Australian communities, far more widespread than governments and parliaments and things like that.
So in 1741, this revival comes out of what was at the time a more formalised sacramental approach to church, yes, and now it was a personal relationship.
It was called real religion, or true vital Christianity. It was a religion of experience. So experience is important in evangelical Christianity. It's an experience of Jesus, and it's become since then far more committed to defending the Bible as the chief repository of a true understanding of Jesus. So the Bible and Jesus, I think, are probably the two chief ingredients which make evangelical Christianity perhaps distinctive from other forms, where instead of talking about a personal relationship with Jesus, you talk about belonging to a church, membership of a church. And instead of talking about the Bible, you might talk about Christian tradition and reason and things like that. But evangelical Christianity is experiential, and it's Jesus-focused, it's biblical.
Well, then that gives rise, at that moment in history, in the 1740s, that gives rise to things that end up being, amongst other things, the freedom of for slavery, William Wilberforce, the Clapham sect, social reform in Great Britain. These were all, by your argument, works of the evangelicals.
Absolutely. You can trace it back specifically to the evangelical revival, and I do in my book, in terms of people. So one of the heroes of my book is Margaret Gambier, who was a Huguenot, who was converted under the wonderful preaching of George Whitefield, the greatest preacher probably of all time.
Okay.
And she married Charles Middleton, who was the Secretary of State for the Navy, he was Comptroller of the Navy, he was the one who chose the ships for the first fleet, and he made sure that all of them were seaworthy, so that when the convicts got here, they got here in great shape, unlike the people who were in the slaving ships who died en route. There's hardly any loss of life in the first fleet. It was an evangelical achievement, which just hasn't been acknowledged by the historians. But the people who actually put it together, Charles Middleton, James Ramsay, who was the surgeon, who got surgeons on board the first fleet, and who was Charles Middleton's minister, and Richards in the Presbyterian, who was the supplier of the provisions for the first fleet. They're all evangelical Christians, and they were determined to make it work, and it did. It was the greatest maritime achievement of its age.
So what you're saying is that, but for the evangelicals, it could have been quite different.
It was on the second fleet, because they then abandoned that group of people, and they got some slave traders to put together the second fleet, and a quarter of them, 267 of them, died.
Goodness.
I mean, the difference between the two is incredible.
And we don't talk about that very often, do we?
No, evangelical Christianity makes a difference.
The idea for the founding of a colony at all, so you've got these overcrowded prison hulks in the Thames, when we all know that the crimes for which people were sent away were, by today's standards, tragic in their laughability. But the idea to send people to the other side of the world, was it in their minds a punishment, or was it an opportunity for a fresh start?
It wasn't a punishment. I mean, I think we can dismiss that categorically. It was an attempt to deal with a great social problem. And the evangelicals thought that it was far more merciful than hanging people. So they supported this particular enterprise. After a while, of course, they were the ones who chiefly led the movement for the abolition of transportation, just as they led the movement for the abolition of the slave trade. They were about abolishing anything that wasn't up to scratch. But transportation was better than hanging, which was the main alternative in the 18th century, and so they were keen to support this particular venture, but they had a much bigger vision than that. They also saw that making a settlement on the other side of the world would be a base for missionary activity throughout the whole of the Pacific and the whole of the Pacific region. And if you think about it, what it did was it made this Christian nation in a world which was surrounded by all the other major religions of the world. And now here is this Christian presence reaching out to the islands. And all the members of the populations of the islands became Christianized far more rapidly even than the Australian Aborigines.
Yes.
It was an incredible achievement, really. They had this idea that they would establish a new nation which embodied all the best things about the old world and evangelized the Aborigines and missionized the South Sea Islanders and brought about a more humane future for convicts transported from England. I think that the government put a lot of effort into the First Fleet. They spent a lot of money on it. They put a lot of thought into it. They wanted this to succeed. And they were very clever in the way they had got the evangelicals on side, because the evangelicals were the ones who really made it work. And it happened not only because of Wilberforce, but Wilberforce was really the second generation of, and the Clapham sect, that was really the second generation. Before that, there was what I call the Thiessen sect, made up of Margaret Gambier and Middleton and Ramsay and Richards and these people. And Wilberforce became part of that, and it was through that that Wilberforce learnt that he must get involved in this work for the abolition of slavery. It was through that the Clapham sect became a reality, because when the Thiessen sect passed on, then that was replaced by the Clapham sect.
Mm.
It's a very interesting sort of continuity, really.
Mm.
Evangelicals believe in conspiring for eternity with each other. They just love it. And they say, what can we abolish next? That's what they were about.
Our guest on Open House is Reverend Dr. Professor Stuart Piggin. And Stuart has just released the first volume of a two-volume work on Australia's history, viewed as an evangelical endeavour. The Fountain of Public Prosperity, it's called. It's very exciting, and it tells a story that we've not, that hasn't been told to us before, and I'm so pleased to be speaking with you, Stuart. When you say they, so you've mentioned names like Wilberforce and so on, you've mentioned the Clapham sect, but they obviously have to get favour of the government of the day in Great Britain. How does that happen?
Wilberforce is a personal friend of William Pitt, the Prime Minister, of course. They're closer to friends. And so I think it's got a lot to do with friendship. But there's a very interesting quotation in the book from the from one of the secretaries to Castlereagh, where he says, "You must realise that there is now more interest," this was 1803, "you must realise that there is now more interest in religion than there has been in England for 100 years. And there is this great new movement within the established church and also among the dissenters. And they are of one common sentiment." He's talking about the evangelical movement, you see. Mm-hmm. And he's saying, if this movement is understood by us, then it will become a great force for good. But if we antagonise it, put it offside, then we won't be able to control the show. Now, this, of course, is in the middle of the Napoleonic Wars and French, just in the aftermath of the French Revolution and so on. A lot is at stake. But here is this movement, the evangelical movement, which is helping them to control a very difficult situation. You know, the famous Halevi thesis in history is that the Methodists, the evangelicals, are the ones who stopped England from having a French Revolution. This is what this is all about. It's all about learning how to cooperate with other forces. So evangelicalism is not about revolution. It's about evolution. Now, this has relevance to Australian history because I think that the really important thing to say about the relationship between church and state in Australia is not that they are separate, which is what people want to say because they're so influenced by American thinking.
Yes,
separation of church and state. The really important thing to say about it is the interdependence of church and state. They're cooperating with each other in an attempt to make a better society.
Yes,
this is when it really comes together.
Yes,
you can add to that the so-called Weber thesis about religion and the rise of capitalism, how religion, Protestant religion, helps people to prosper. And if you have the synergy, the cooperation of church, state, and business, that's when you really start to make some progress in society. That's what we should be trying to achieve now. We should make this work.
That's right. Well, we're talking about theories of history, and I wanted to ask you, well, your book in a way gives testament to your view about your theory of history. There's another view of history, of course, Stuart, often told about the Australian colonisation, and that is of an invading force that takes the land, that then starts to oppress the original inhabitants, and as a result changes forever their life expectations, their experience, their identity, their whole sense of being, and produces very adverse outcomes. How do we put together what you've said, that evangelicals were concerned to come to Australia for the improvement of the people who came here, with what happened to the Aboriginal people?
I think that's a fantastic question. And I don't dissent from that other view that you have put. I think the invasion of Australia was an incredible historical disaster for Aboriginal people.
It was.
There's no doubt about it. And on the frontier, as the whites progressed across Australia, there were chronic wars until the 1930s. It just went on and on. It is a very sad story indeed.
We actually haven't told that story well, just in passing, and very occasionally you come across the commemoration of a massacre here or a massacre there, but it's not part of our daily consciousness as it ought, and maybe that's in our future. But nevertheless, go on. You're about to say how we can reconcile those things.
I think that the evangelical presence was consistently in one direction, namely to ameliorate the problems, to minimise the problems where they could, but they were not equal to the task. There weren't enough of them. And the economic advantages of taking Aboriginal land and exploiting it for our own purposes were just overwhelming. And so I think that the Christian message was something which kept alive in the consciences of a lot of Australians, including the people who were despoiling the Aboriginal people. They kept alive the reality that they've got to do something better than this. But it's taken a long time in order to achieve this. But if you look at what the Christians brought to this debate, they brought the view that an Aboriginal person is a real human being. Not everybody believed that at the time. But the Christians, the evangelical Christians who are using the same ideas for the abolition of the slave trade, believe that very strongly. These brothers and sisters we have of different colour, they are our brothers and sisters. Am I not a man and a brother is the question asked in the abolition of the slave trade. I am a brother. And they believe that the Aboriginal people were not barbarians. They thought the barbarians were the people who exploited them. So they had this understanding of barbarism as a moral thing, and if you break that morality, then you're the real barbarian. Yes. That was an important part of the discussion.
Yes, it shouldn't be forgotten that these were the people who had fought so hard to abolish slavery because of these ideals that we are all in the image of God. Why would those people then come to Australia and replicate that? Well, they didn't, and yet history hasn't told that story well. So often in this blameworthy sort of approach that we get these days, the Christians are blamed for what occurred, whereas your thesis is, and you've put it so beautifully in the prologue to your book, that the evangelicals were standing between the governor and the governed.
Yes, yes. They tried to be a bridge. They tried to be a middle way. This is how they understood their role in society. This book is about the public role of Christianity. It's not so much about the private religious beliefs of people, but it's about its public manifestation.
Yes.
And so what they were trying to do was to be a bridge to put together these forces which had come into conflict. This is an incredible historical reality which is happening now. Apparently the dispossession of the lands of Aboriginal people in Australia is one of the great, great dispossessions of all history. And it was just incredible. And it was done by relatively few people. And so trying to deal with that is a problem that we're now having to come up with a way forward. And my argument is we must keep the Christian message in the argument, because it's got a lot of terribly important ideas for effective reconciliation. Ephesians chapter 2. We've got to make it work.
What can we learn, Stuart, from the values that came here? I'm going to use this phrase, people are very familiar with it. The vision and mission statement of the evangelicals who wanted to make Australia a truly great nation, a model nation of humanitarianism. What can we borrow from their vision and mission that we could apply today, firstly to Aboriginal reconciliation, but to other forms of public service?
A terrific question. I think an enormous amount. You see, there is a great debate, as you know, about Australian values. What are Australian values?
That's right.
And I don't know if you've noticed, most historians just give up on it. They laugh, they mock the efforts that people have come up with in order to answer that question. And they mock it because they don't have any answers themselves. They have not identified what real Australian values are. And it's partly because they have left Christianity out of account. If you look at what happened in Australian history, was the as a result of the efforts of governors and so on, churches were multiplied all over the land. The central part of the book really is something that historians have not noticed, but as a result of the Church Acts, four churches were built in almost every small community in Australia. And if you go into every country town, you'll see often on opposite street corners, Catholic, Methodist, Presbyterian, and Anglican church. And they were all built about the same time. And when one of those churches said, oh, our church is too humble, we don't want this little timber shack anymore, we want a big stone Gothic thing, they pulled their church down, they put up one of those, and all the others did the same. And they did it about the same time, they put up these churches about the same value, four of them. What that meant was that you had a lot of churches, you had a lot of ministers. This is completely different from England. In England, in any community, you had one church. Not only did you have four churches in Australia, but they were all learning from each other. I call this in the book holy emulation or sanctified competition. Most historians talk about sectarianism, you see. They say this is a great rivalry, but that's because historians like to emphasize conflict.
Yes,
but most of the time, these churches were all cooperating with each other.
Yes.
They were learning from each other, and it meant that we were one of the most Christianized nations on earth, which is why I have sympathy for those who want to say that Australia was a Christian nation. I don't think that any such thing is ever possible. But if you want to say that, apply that term to any nation in Australia in the 19th century, late 19th century, was about as Christian a nation as you'll ever get in terms of values. Now, in terms of values, what were these values? Our civilization, I don't think historians in Australia have understood this terribly well, because they don't look enough at the background of the whole thing. They just look at what happens in Australia itself, and they don't look at the roots of the whole thing. And they say, well, Australia was settled during the French Revolution and the Enlightenment, and therefore these are all Enlightenment values and reason and that sort of stuff. In actual fact, the people who talked about reason more than anybody were the evangelicals. John Wesley's works, if you look at John Wesley's works, Volume 17 or whatever it is, it's just Wesley on reason. He's very strong on reason. And evangelicals are very strong on usefulness. They love the word usefulness. They love it to be useful. And now people have said utilitarianism is what fashioned Australia.
Yes.
Well, the evangelicals are very strong on utilitarianism as well. They just embodied all these things. But what they chiefly brought to Australia was an understanding of civilization which incorporated biblical Christian values of faith, hope, love, and humility with classical virtues: courage, justice, temperance, prudence. Now, to us, those things sound Christian. We think of courage as a Christian thing. We think about justice as a Christian thing. Temperance is a Christian thing, because Christians are always involved in temperance movements. Now, these are all classical values, and they are values which are, when you think about it, they're all about the things which make me a better person. They're all about my character.
Mm.
But the Christian values, they're all about other people. They're all about our concern for other people. Faith is all about reliability in our relationship.
And it's right in saying that there's a vision for society amongst that, isn't there?
Well, I think the thing is that those Christian values and those classical virtues are what makes our civilization what it is. But if you think about them, they're not always easily reconciled with each other. Mm. They're in some sort of conflict with each other.
Yes, that's right.
So I like to exploit this particular land. It takes a lot of courage to do it, and how do I do it? Because I'm exploiting the land to this extent. So it takes a lot of courage to be a very effective settler in Australia in the 19th century. But it's not a Christian value necessarily. And I think the chief Christian value actually is humility. That is the distinctive thing, which if we lose our Christian heritage,
mm-hmm.
that is the first thing that goes. If you think about people who are very vocal at the moment in opposing Christianity,
mm-hmm.
they're often people who are pretty cool themselves, really. There's a lack of humility there, which is terribly conspicuous if you think about it, because most Australians are humble people. They don't like big noting of people. And even the tall poppy thing, you know, the anti-tall poppy thing, all of that actually may be attributed to Christian views of humility. That's how it's influenced us in terms of our sort of social national psyche.
Well, so then my question to you was, what can we learn from the attitudes, the postures of the founding evangelicals in Australia that could be helpful today? And your answer sounds to me like it's shaping up to say, well, chief amongst all of these, if we had a society that was built on greater humility, that would be our starting point.
Oh, well, that always helps. but I think that the attitude of regarding all people as equal in the sight of God,
yes,
that is a terribly important concept. We would not tolerate what's going on with asylum seekers if we were going through a religious revival at the moment. We'd say, really, we cannot continue with this. This is sub-Christian. We've got to do better than this. It's not that it's an easy thing to solve. And it's like unemployment. Unemployment's never an easy thing to solve. But we can say as Christians, unemployment is always wrong, because it means that it, people don't have a means of maintaining a livelihood, and that creates all sorts of incredible problems. And what they're doing with asylum seekers is always wrong, even if it's, you know, even if it's very difficult to come up with an alternative solution.
And failing, so asylum seekers looking after the impoverished in many ways, including, as you said, creating meaningful work opportunities for people, reconciling...
And reconciling Aborigines.
Yes.
That is something we can't give up on. We just got to make... That is the big Australian problem we must solve.
Yes. Finally, on that very last point, perhaps where you begin your first volume is an interesting story that you could briefly recount for us now about Dawes,
an explorer,
an astronomer, very important in the early days of the colony, and an evangelical.
And his best friends, it seems, in the colony were not white, but Indigenous people. And he was keen to learn their language. So he wrote these notebooks in which he put down the language of the Aboriginal people at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he started off by putting down individual words and realised that didn't work, and then he put down whole phrases. And those whole phrases tell us a lot about what was happening in the colony at the time.
Now, there's a whole lot to tell about all of that story, but I want to focus in on one incident when Dawes was asked to take a party and... Well, it can't be dressed up. Hunt down and kill for retribution 10 Aboriginal men for something that had happened in the colony.
Yes. Yes, the governor's gamekeeper was murdered by Aboriginal people or an Aboriginal person. And so the governor temporarily lost his humanity. I mean, he normally didn't give these sorts of orders. It looks incredible now. But he wanted 10 Aboriginal heads on the gibbet, and he ordered Dawes and company to go out and get it. Now, the people Dawes objected. He didn't want to do this. But the chaplain said to him, your job is to obey the government authority, so...
Yeah, so the chaplain said, the Bible says we should obey those in authority. You've been given a direct order by the governor. You've got to go out and hunt down 10 people. Now, Dawes found a way to not do that. Turns out his party never found any Aboriginal men.
They made sure they didn't find anybody.
That's it.
They were quite determined not to. And then Dawes came back and then he said, look, I really have offended against my own conscience. I really regret that I've done this. I shouldn't have done this. So he fell out with the governor and regrettably he left. But interestingly, he became the first teacher of Church Missionary Society missionaries. And what he says, well, what I have to offer is I can teach you a language of the people of Botany Bay. it's one of the things that he did with the first missionaries, teaching the language of the people of Botany Bay.
And also acknowledged, so what a contribution, but also acknowledged by a historian at Sydney University in 1891, Professor Wood, as Australia's first conscientious objector.
Yes. Yes, Professor Wood was a nonconformist himself, one who was alert to these things, and he could see that Dawes was an exceptional individual. I argue that if we followed Dawes' thinking, we would have had a lot happier outcome with Aboriginal people, because he had a feeling for their culture. He seemed to understand lots of the things about them that subsequent people had not managed to. Come up with for 100 years, particularly about the importance of language and how language worked in order to create reality.
And to use it in the way that you've used it so well in the book, a beautiful, simple, well-told illustration of how the evangelicals had a different sense of why they were here and what the purpose of it all was because of their belief in God and their personal relationship with Jesus. Something that allowed them to, as you've said, stand sometimes between the authorities and those who are governed in a way that says there is something more important than man's temporal authority. And
well put. Yes. And could I just make this point, Stephen? With reference to culture wars and how you approach these things, I say in the book that I greatly admire a book that's been written about Dawes by a literary figure, really, not really an historian, called Gibson. And he wrote this marvellous book about 27 views of the style coming out of the world thought about William Dawes. He has 27 different perspectives on Dawes, but not one of them has, not one of them is Christian. One of them recognises his evangelical commitment. And so when he looks at the notebooks, he just leaves out the bits which refer to Christianity and evangelicalism and things like that, which is quite astonishing because he looks at every word terribly carefully, but those he just doesn't even see. Now, I say in the book, I'm not really criticising this. I'm just pointing out that this is what happens all the time in Australian history. And to have a complete view of Australian history, we've really got to put it all together. We've got to say to each other, I think what you've done, Gibson, is fantastic. I really do. But I really don't think we should add this as well, because this makes sense of something which otherwise doesn't make a lot of sense. I think that he goes to great lengths to explain Dawes' commitments and insights, which are far more easily explained by the fact that he was an evangelical Christian. That's what made him the way he was.
Well, do you know, Stuart, the catchphrase for Open House, our own mission statement about ourselves, is this: to look at life through the lens of faith and point to hope. And what you've just described is exactly that, that sometimes if people don't have godly vision, if they don't have eyes to see, they won't see it. But our job, and yours as an historian, and I think mine as a broadcaster, is to point to these things that are happening that are of God and say to people, now you can get to know the Creator. But anyway, that's a story for another day. I'm so glad that we've been able to have this time together. Thank you for the work you've done, and thank you for this interview.
Well, thank you so much, Stephen. I hope you could make some sense of it, dear brother. The thing you just said about hope is very inspiring. Because I've been for 15 years in the ancient history department, I can see how this is terribly important for Christians who gave us this idea of hope about positive change in the future. You see, the Romans believed that every change was retrograde. Yes. They wanted to go backwards all the time. They thought that every change was a mistake and it was not desirable. Therefore, they tried to keep the lid on everything all the time. They tried to stop change. It's the Christians who say, look, God's in control of the future. Let's get out there and find it. It's terrific. Wonderful.
Dr. Stuart Piggin.
Discover more Open House podcasts at openhousecommunity.com.au.